I'm delighted to introduce you to our newest supporting sponsor, a team human enabler in more ways than one, Groucho. Groucho's a platform that answers the most common question we get at Team Human: how do I find the others? Well, this is it. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman, share your interests and aspirations, and Groucho's curators will hand assemble a real dinner club for you. You meet twice a month in order to establish some lasting friendships. Groucho takes care of all the logistics. The thing I like is that it was built by artists, not tech pros, people who wanted to recreate what they got from artist residencies, curated intentionally, and with time and space to connect. That's how the founders met their own best collaborators, friends, and even life partners. So check out mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. I want to tell a story today, a hard story for me, but I want to see where it takes us. I think it'll be good. Let's find out. But first, let me remind you, please subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, or even better, join through Patreon to gain access to ad-free audios and videos, the Team Human Discord, invitation to premieres and exclusive live video salons with me, and free access to live events when I'm on tour. That's patreon.com/teamhuman. I don't usually use this space to tell stories, but there's one I want to share with you, something of an homage to my best friend from college, Stephen Ratushewitz, who died 40 years ago this month. It's also an inquiry into how we experience and metabolize grief together in the time we do have here. It's a difficult place for me to go, but I feel pretty sure there's some value, even maybe some joy, once we get through to the other side. So here goes. I went to Princeton University for all the wrong reasons. A Jewish public school kid who got in on grades at a time when the bulk of students were still members of a legacy I didn't even know existed until after I got there. People with the same names as retail stores, corporations, even a colonized country or two. I went for the dream of inclusion in the preppy elite, thinking that's where smart, successful people were. But I quickly found out it was a lot of prep school trust fund kids and young Republicans and Southern rock fans who hung Confederate flags out their dorm room windows. Not everyone, of course, but that's the keg culture that dominated. And they had this strange tradition where on the first night before class, everyone surrounds the original 1700s campus building and someone tries to steal the clapper from the bell in the bell tower. Like they either climb up the building from the outside or find a way in. And whoever steals it is remembered somehow, I guess, whatever. So all these students, almost all guys, Princeton had a worse than 2-to-1 ratio of men to women at that time anyway, they're all milling around this building. And I lock eyes with a guy in ripped jeans wearing a red bandana over this messy black hair, not a preppy. And there I was, practically in preppy drag, wanting to prove to him that I wasn't one of these dudes. I was a fellow public school artsy outsider in this sea of privilege. And I guess I wasn't pulling off the preppy thing, because he just came right up to me as if he recognized me as an ally, and he said, "Yo, I have an idea." So we found this big stick shaped like what we imagined a clapper must look like, and we made it look like we just emerged from the building with it, and we ran into the woods screaming that we had the thing, and we were pursued by a couple of upperclassmen that we couldn't outrun, and when they finally got to us, they said they represented some alumnus group, and they'd give us like $1,000 for the clapper. It's like, what? What kind of sick world had we signed up for? And Stephen and I, we talked really most of the night, and then we vowed, like there and then, whichever one of us was alive in 50 years would come back and prank these people in some awful way. We figured we'd be too old to get prosecuted for a prank, right, when we're in our 70s or 80s, but it was a real pact. And we were partners in crime after that. Well, maybe not so much partners in crime as partners in justice. Like one day we offered our resident advisor's pet gerbil its freedom, right? We told it that in four languages, we told it that we would open its door for 1 minute to give it the opportunity to escape. But we informed it that with freedom came great risk, like being able to find food and avoid predators. And the gerbil chose to remain domesticated, right? We did graffiti protests when they closed the library to the public and other stuff that risked our status there. Stephen, more than me. We went to punk clubs in New York. We hung out with the Dead Boys at Max's Kansas City and do drugs and made art. And we lived in ways we felt defied the elitist wealth networks of the Forbes and the Rhodes who graced our classes. I mean, in those days, just having an earring or a bit of red dye in your hair was a statement of protest. And we made music, bouncing tracks back and forth on cassette recorders. I directed a play he wrote about an exchange student who was actually a bowl of Jell-O. We took an impromptu trip to Montreal, where we met a band of Haitian voodoo drummers and got them across the border to the U.S., apparently holding a lot of mushrooms because they gifted us a big bag when we dropped them off in Maine. And I'm not sure how much I would have done of that stuff without Stephen and his confidence. He was always a notch or two more adventurous and righteous than I was. I'd attend an illegal protest, but he'd cut the chain link fence barricade. I was aware of racism, but he ate at the college's Third World Center, where people of color gathered and forged solidarity. He was like a cross between Lou Reed and Naomi Klein leftism, and increasingly intolerant of anything contaminated by establishment approval. I wanted to be as confident in my convictions as he was, but it appeared to come at a cost. You know, no compromise and lots of conflict. And things actually got a little strained between us after I came back from a semester at a theater school. I got almost too into theater for him. You know, one time I didn't take a hit of a joint because I had a play rehearsal coming up, and he said something like, "What happened to you? I barely recognize you." You know, we stayed friends, but I had chosen the establishment route of pursuing theater and an MFA program in California, where he went total indie, working temp jobs, living off lentils while playing bass and doing graffiti, and some hard drugs. But we wrote letters, and I told him about all the stuff I was doing out at California Institute of the Arts, the insanely wonderful place that launched Pee Wee Herman and Tim Burton and Don Cheadle and me, right? We had digital music, Devise Theater, Gamelan, and something about that, the taste of that place tempted him. I think he had his fill of like hard drugs as well. We had too many friends who'd went over the edge and weren't coming back. He also had a younger brother who'd gone into business in a bottom-up entrepreneurial way. I think he was working on a business plan for something like a movie theater that was also a cafe and a motel, right? An honest business serving culture and dating and I don't know. And it felt to Stephen like a cool place to try to do something. So he offered to come out, see what CalArts was all about, and then drive cross-country with me back to New York for the summer. And we'd use the trip to reconnect and write a screenplay together that I could then direct and his brother could screen at the new theater. And we had a great couple of days. He loved CalArts. Everyone does. It's one giant building of insane art and play. You know, the motto of that place is no technique before need. So it's a supported free-for-all, a best of both worlds celebration of weird. And Steve could see the appeal as well as the kind of discipline I was developing as an artist. You know, committing to craft is not selling out. And well, this is where the bad part happens. Stephen wanted to see the Grand Canyon on the way back to New York. His grandmother said to watch sunrise from the South Rim. But this meant getting there from L.A. by sunrise. And we were having a great drive from L.A. through Death Valley, reconnecting on every level, from psychedelics to Buddhism to Wittgenstein. We didn't even have any drugs or weed or anything with us, just pure joy. And it was really late, like 2 a.m. We pulled into a rest stop for gas and food, but all they had was a candy machine. So we got this big brownie to share. It was maybe 2 in the morning, and I was just too tired to drive. But we were close enough to make it by sunrise, so Stephen took over, using the brownie for an extra boost. Well, I guess you know how that went, right? Trigger warning. I felt us going off the road as Stephen shouted, "Oh, shit." He tried to navigate for a moment or so, then plowed into a large juniper. And it wasn't as soft as it looked. It was a loud, hard bam, right? Blood, glass, everywhere. Everything hurt, but nothing hurt. I looked over, and Steve was unconscious, pinned in there with metal and branches. And I managed to get out of the car. It was accordion, squished. You know, glass in my hands and face, fucked up leg. You know, I made it around to his side and pulled back a piece of metal that was pressed against his neck. But instead of coming to, he just kind of slumped over and blood came out. You know, I sat him up again, but I knew what was happening. He wasn't in there anymore. And so I went out into the highway. It was like 4 in the morning, and there was no one to wave over. I just stood there in the road, under the sky, and screamed. There was nothing to do. You know, eventually, the truckers came. They sat me down against something, then the ambulance. The paramedics kept working on me. They thought I was thrown from the car because it was too squished for anyone to survive. And I kept sending them back to Steve. They said, "Don't worry about Steve. A special crew would be coming to extract him." And it was in the ambulance that I got kind of weird. I imagined there were drugs in the car and that the cops were going to find them. Should I take responsibility? Should I say they were Steve's? He wasn't going to get in trouble anymore. I guess I gave my mind like a fake problem to work on because there were no drugs. And the ambulance guy, he was asking questions like how many fingers was he holding up or what I had for breakfast. And I remember I asked him if people get over stuff like this. He was barely my age, right? Maybe 20. And he looked at me like it was like way beyond his pay grade. Then he said something like, you know, people go on with their lives. They live on. And it was at that moment I decided I would live on. But not just for me, but for Stephen as well. I'd live for the both of us. Incorporate his life's mission, his soul, into me. It was a tough summer, but when I got back to school, I kind of leaned into Brecht and more political theater, Marx, theater of the oppressed, everything indie. I merged my own love of the arts and spirit with Stephen's commitment to absolute integrity and never surrendering to the compromised values of the status quo. It made for a tough path all these years. I eventually quit theater because so much of it catered to the elites who paid for it. You know, it was at best apologist or a stand-in for on-the-ground activism. I could hear Stephen's voice condemning the fancy productions. You know, the net, it started out as indie, bottom-up, an alternative to that highbrow art scene, but as you all know, ended up being anything but anti-corporate, anything but a safe haven for proletariat art and culture. And I spent 20 years trying to live and write at the intersection of culture and social justice, holding the double agenda, never leaning totally into art or culture or reverie as long as there was one person suffering somewhere else. It wasn't conscious at all. It was just after a couple of decades living like this, it just who I became. Smart, creative, but always conflicted. You can even hear it on some of my early Team Human shows. Like there's a conversation with an Omaha, Nebraska artist, Brigitte McQueen, and I'm asking her I'm asking here, is it okay to have fun making art like this while there's such much suffering and starvation?
What tech taketh away, it can also giveth back. Think about it. We've handed our social lives over to platforms designed to keep us clicking, not connecting, turned human relationships into follower counts and reaction metrics. Our new favorite sponsor, Groucho, is a corrective. Founded by artists who want to flip the script, instead of atomizing us like a social network, they connect people in real life. Human curators place you in a local club with people who complement your interests and your journey. Share evenings out with your club twice a month until real connections take hold. Then, the people at Groucho place you into a new hand-assembled club for the social fabric to grow. Groucho wasn't built by tech bros, but artists who wanted to recreate the serendipity of their own art residencies, where they found lifelong collaborators, friends, even life partners. So come on, Team Human, let's find the others. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman.
And she said it's even more of an obligation to joyfully make art, but I didn't quite understand what she meant. Not in my body anyway. Until I did a ceremony a couple of years ago, yeah, facilitated mushroom journey. And I was lying there, experiencing the mycelia as if they were feeling around inside my body, reaching up, tendrils from my gut. And when they got to my heart, they just held there. It was really painful, terrible, a squeezing, like the mycelia had wrapped around my heart and were clenching. I thought maybe they were hurting me, but then they said, in that silent way a plant can talk, "Oh, you have a broken heart." Huh? I mean, I assumed they were talking about my marriage or something, but it was even older than that. No, you're brokenhearted. The distinction mattered, right? I was back there at the accident. I saw Stephen in the car bleeding out and realized what the pain was. Not just mourning. It's that my heart was broken from trying to hold his heart along with mine. It was too much. I'd literally taken responsibility for him. Not to him, but for him. Trying to fit two lives, two hearts in the space of one. But the mushrooms, they weren't squeezing my heart like that. They were just showing me what I was doing to myself all that time. It was pain I was carrying with me. I couldn't hold his heart in mine anymore. So I gave consent to let him go. And the pain in my heart stopped. It was like I could feel him going. I had to let him go. It wasn't good for him either. And I cried a bunch. It may have been the first time I cried about this since I was there in the middle of the highway. And as I wept, I started to feel like the tears were no longer my own. They were infinite and an ocean of tears beneath us all the time. This shared, almost infinite well of trauma and grief. And all we can do is make like a mushroom and metabolize it. We're all in this churn, this swirl together. It's painful, violent, pathetic, unnecessarily cruel. It's us. It's the babies getting blown up in wars, the refugees being turned away, the people caught in the gears of the machine or its toxic clouds. We're all in this swirl, this insane, violent swirl. And as I considered that, I started to see some old friends, ones who had passed on and were now bobbing around in this swirling ocean. Not Steve, but Robert Anton Wilson. He had this Alfred E. Newman, "What Me Worry" face on, as if to say, it's not so tragic, it's really just ridiculous. I saw Paul Krasner in the swirl too, the satirist with a smirk, and Terence McKenna with his wry smile, and Genesis Peorage with his mock demonic laughter. Each of them in the swirl, metabolizing the tears in their own painful but joyful ways, each one discovering how to do this processing, this metabolizing, not with anguish, but in something like bliss, accepting the cycle of death and life and death. I released the stubborn punk insistence and resistance of my 20-something best friend and accepted the possibility that I really do have a different mission. I mean, what if art is our way of metabolizing all this grief, of joining this collective swirl as the bliss? Think Happy Buddha. After realizing that all existence is pain and suffering, he starts to smile? That's his middle-age wisdom? But that's precisely it. True compassion allows you to metabolize this grief and sorrow and transform it into something else, death into life. I'm not saying Stephen was wrong. He was as true to a cause as a human could be. I'm just saying his path wasn't my path, and trying to do both became an unnecessary source of conflict. And holding onto his heart and mission was a way of delaying the pain, not letting him die. Stephen died. Gah, our resistance to death is so much of our problem right now. All the tech bros and wealthy folks working on life extension or the end of death altogether, like that's gonna be fun. If your life expectancy was 10,000 years, like some of these folks are suggesting, then the only way you could die is in a freak accident. So who's going to even go outside or go in a car? The price of eternal life is that everything becomes a risk. Your highest probability of dying 9,000 years early. Better stay inside and not move. The precious scarcity of this existence, the brevity of life, is part of what makes it so beautiful, part of what gives us the opportunity to recognize how special each of us is. Something that the wealthiest sociopaths at the top of our civilization's pyramid would do well to accept and celebrate, because the swirl is coming for them too. No matter how high up in the pyramid you go, if you're alive, you're still in the swirl. If you exist, you're in the swirl. Hell, if you used to exist, you're in the swirl. We're all in it, and we're all in it together. That's the team human awareness. That's what no amount of machines or wealth can deny, not for very long. Whether we tear down the towers with protest, reveal their faulty foundations with art, or melt them with love, we're all doing our part in our own ways. That's why there's so many of us. Anyway, I love you, Steve. I'll see you in the swirl. Thanks for being on Team Human. Please subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, or even better, join through Patreon to gain access to ad-free audios and videos, the Team Human Discord, invitations to premieres, and exclusive live salons, and free access to our live events when I'm on tour. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peace.